Good day. Today is Wednesday, 3rd December 2025. And again, let me remind you before I start the video, if once you've watched the video or whichever part of the video you want to watch and you've liked what you've heard, then please indicate that fact by ticking the like button. Anyway, let me proceed with the rest of the video. And today's video is going to be largely about entirely about the Ukraine conflict. There's still rumblings and uncertainties about the situation with Venezuela. President Trump appeared to have announced a no-fly zone over Venezuela. He then seems to have walked that back somewhat. For the record, flights to Venezuela have mostly ended, but not entirely. So flights from Russia, Colombia, Panama continue to Venezuela. So there is no actual no-fly zone in effect at the present time. But anyway, the situation with Venezuela remains unresolved. And by the way, the same is true, in a sense, about the situation with respect to Ukraine, which will be the main topic of this programme. So, yesterday was a busy day in terms of diplomacy, and it began with a brief press conference that was given by President Putin of Russia in advance of his meeting with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, the two envoys sent to Moscow by the President of the United States, Donald Trump. And the press conference itself, which is, as I said, fairly brief, but it was typical Putin in some respects. And it basically highlighted the fact that Putin was in no mood of any kind to make any substantive concessions. And he was asked about the situation in Pokrovsk. He said that Pokrovsk is now firmly under Russian control. He explained the importance of Pokrovsk for future Russian military plans. He said it is a good bridgehead for accomplishing all the objectives set at the beginning of the special military operation. That is, from here, from this bridgehead, this sector, the Russian army is well positioned to advance in any direction the General Staff deems most appropriate. The words that I find most interesting in these comments were these: it's all the objectives set at the beginning of the special military operation, which leaves open the possibility, by the way, that these objectives might be expanded, and that if there isn't a peace agreement, the objectives might become greater. Anyway, as I said, Putin discussed the situation in Pokrovsk. He spoke about the fact that the Russians are indeed in full control of Pokrovsk. He renewed his offer for journalists from the West, and indeed from Ukraine also, to visit Pokrovsk and to confirm for themselves that it is indeed under Russian control. He was then asked about the situation in Kupiansk. For the record, President Zelensky continues to claim that the Ukrainians have won some great battle in Kupiansk. He was asked whether this is true. He said, "I think the Ukrainian leadership appears focused on issues other than the situation in the active combat zone and seems to be living on another planet." And he went on to say, regarding Kupiansk, the city is divided into two parts, a large central part of it on the right bank of the river, he means the West Bank, and a smaller part on the left bank in the east. Russian troops control both the right bank and the left bank areas entirely. A separate nearby settlement, Kupiansk-Uzlovoy, is located a bit further south along the river. I believe there are 2,000 buildings there. Fighting is ongoing there. The Russian army holds about 600 to 650 buildings and is advancing. I believe that the settlement will also come under full Russian control within a few days. This is a different settlement. And then he went on to say that the enemy force, which is surrounded, 15 battalions, is located on the left bank of the river, that is to say on the east bank, and Russian troops have begun eliminating it. Now, I've discussed at some length what Putin has said about the situation in Kupiansk, because over the last couple of hours, yesterday and today, various Ukrainian channels and some neutral ones have been talking about a successful Ukrainian counterattack in the Kupiansk area, which is supposed to have recovered some control of the western suburbs of Kupiansk, broken into the residential areas of Kupiansk and gained control of these areas. There has been absolutely no video footage confirming any of that. And I'm going to say straightforwardly, based partly on what Putin has said, but also based on my own experience, that I believe that this entire offensive, this claim from Ukrainian sources that they have recaptured Western Kupiansk, is completely imaginary. It is entirely fictitious. It is invented. I have been myself bitten on several occasions by Ukrainian claims of counterattacks, which I have taken seriously. I don't believe that this counterattack has any reality at all. I believe it is an entirely a media construct. I will explain why later in this program. But anyway, that's what Putin had to say about the situation in Kupiansk. He then talked a great deal about the Europeans. He was asked about the Europeans, and he was asked, why are they not involved in the negotiations? And he said that Russia has not excluded the Europeans of the negotiations to settle the conflict in Ukraine. He said that they abruptly cut off contact with Russia. That was their initiative. Why did they do this? Because they embraced the conflict of inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia and, by all appearances, continue to live under this illusion. Intellectually, they understand. They understand perfectly well that this possibility has long since vanished, that it was never feasible. They once believed what they desired, but they still can't and won't admit it. They withdrew from this process of their own accord. That is the first point. And then Putin went on to say that the Europeans, unable to admit to themselves or to admit publicly that their plan to defeat Russia in Ukraine has failed, what they're doing instead is they're doing everything they possibly can to sabotage any ongoing negotiation process between the United States and Russia to settle the Ukrainian conflict by making demands which they know the Russians can never accept. Demands, for example, for an unconditional ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, for Ukraine to preserve its right to join NATO, for Ukraine to have an army of 800,000 men. It's been pointed out, by the way, that such an army, 800,000 men, would be bigger than the British, French and German armies put together. And I believe that it would be roughly the size of those three armies plus the Turkish army, which is the second biggest army in NATO put together. Larry Johnson at Sonar 21 has discussed this thoroughly. We are talking about a ridiculous figure for a peacetime Ukrainian army, when the Europeans say that Ukraine should be entitled to an army of that size, they're simply plucking grotesque numbers out of the air. Ukraine has no ability in peacetime to sustain indefinitely an army of that scale. Again, it's clearly a wrecking manoeuvre and one which no one should take seriously. And then Putin said that the Europeans have no peace agenda. They are on the side of war. Even when they ostensibly attempt to introduce amendments to Trump's proposals, we see this clearly, all their amendments are directed towards one single aim, to completely obstruct the peace process, to put forward demands that are utterly unacceptable to Russia. And they understand this, and basically what they're trying to do is then to put the blame on Russia. When Russia rejects these absurd proposals, the Europeans turn round and say that it's Russia's fault that the war is continuing. And then there was perhaps the section which has attracted the most international attention and which has been the subject of relentless spin in the Western media. Because if you read Western media articles casually, if you judge purely on the basis of the titles of some of these articles, you might have gained the impression that Putin was threatening Europe and threatening Europe with war and saying that Russia is ready for war with Europe and that the Russians basically have threatened Europe with something akin to conquest or destruction. You have to read the articles themselves, and this is not, by the way, true even of all of the articles. You have to read the longer articles thoroughly to understand that Putin's words were actually nuanced. Actually, it's incorrect to say that they were nuanced, because this is a complete distortion to the point of a misrepresentation of what he actually said. And I'm going to read out now the Kremlin's transcript, English language transcript of what he actually said about war in Europe. He said, "We are not planning to go to war against Europe. I have said that 100 times. If Europe wants to wage a war against us and suddenly starts a war with us, we are ready. There should be no doubt about that. The only question is, if Europe suddenly starts a war against us, I think very quickly, Europe is not Ukraine. In Ukraine, we are acting with surgical precision. You see my point, don't you? It is not a war in the direct modern sense of the word. If Europe suddenly decides to go to war against us and actually follows through with it, then a situation must arise very quickly where we will be left with no one to negotiate with." Now, this was said in response to this question. And this is from a Russian media outlet. Hungarian Foreign Minister Szijjártó said today that we might find ourselves in a state of war with Europe, literally today. He says that the European portion of NATO plans to bring its forces to full combat readiness by 2029, and that by 2030 there is a risk of an armed conflict. This is a very serious, almost sensational statement. What do you think about it? Are they really preparing for something? So what Putin said is this: we are not looking for war with Europe. We have no plans to attack Europe. We have said that 100 times. We are aware of all of these statements from the Hungarians. We are aware of all the overheated extreme rhetoric about war coming out of Europe. If the Europeans completely take leave of their senses and attack us, then of course we are ready. We will defend ourselves. But in that case, people in Europe should understand that in such a war, which will be for Russia a defensive war, it will not be a war like the war in Ukraine, where the Russians have repeatedly pulled their punches. They have not conducted the war. They have not conducted an all-out war. They have restricted themselves to a special military operation, which has prevented the Russians from doing all sorts of things that they might do in an all-out war. They might use far more powerful weapons than the ones that they have used, for example, in Ukraine. And Putin said that in such an unrestricted war, which would in effect be a world war, World War III, then a situation may arise very quickly where we will be left with no one to negotiate with. That is a hint that if the Europeans are crazy enough to launch a war against Russia, then it will be an all-out war and nuclear weapons might very well be used. And that would, of course, be the end of Europe, at least. It might be the end of humanity as well, but it would certainly quite plausibly be the end of Europe. And he said he clearly hopes, that that is not going to happen. And then he turned to what I think is a much more interesting passage altogether, one which has attracted very little attention, but which I think reflects the rage, anger that exists in Moscow over a particular event, and that is the attacks that have been taking place on oil tankers that have been involved in the trading, carrying oil from Russia and transporting it to various countries and places around the world. So there have been two attacks, heavy damage done to two tankers in the Black Sea, both in Turkey's economic zone. The Turks are furious about this. Erdogan has spoken out against it. Kazakhstan is furious about this. Kazakhstan has spoken out against it. As I pointed out already, these tankers were heading to Novorossiysk, where they were going to load up oil. And the oil, some of that oil that is exported through Novorossiysk, comes from Kazakhstan, which is, of course, in terms of access to the world ocean, a landlocked country. Kazakhstan does have a coastline, but it is on the Caspian Sea, which is an enclosed sea. Kazakhstan's oil exports are exported through the Russian Black Sea port of Novorossiysk. So Kazakhstan was furious about this attack. By the way, there are US oil majors who are involved in the consortium that exports oil from Kazakhstan. And apparently they also have facilities in Novorossiysk, though I've heard nothing from them. But Kazakhstan was furious about it. Turkey is furious about it. Russia is furious about it because the ships were attacked on the high seas. They were not Russian owned. They were owned by international shipping companies, one of them based in Hong Kong, by the way, which suggests, to me at least, Chinese ownership, both under African flags. And as I said, this was an attack on the high seas. Now, at least two other Russian merchant ships were also attacked in the Black Sea. Neither apparently suffered significant damage, and one was able, under its own power, to reach Novorossiysk. But since then, there have been further attacks on other merchant ships involved in trading with Russia. And I believe that two have been attacked. Definitely one has been attacked, perhaps two. And both attacks took place off the east coast of, the west coast of Africa. Apparently, the closest African country with a cold coastline was Senegal. And again, these were attacks carried out with drones. And obviously, for Ukraine to be able to conduct attacks with drones on merchant ships involved in trade with Russia off the coast of West Africa, that can only have been done with the assistance of certain African countries, possibly, but also definitely with the assistance of certain countries of the West. Now, there's been much discussion and speculation about this in independent media and on the various threads and also in the Russian media as well. Now, in independent media, on the various threads, the speculation has mostly centred on Britain. It is assumed that it is the British who have been assisting Ukraine to conduct this offensive, these attacks on these merchant ships, which, to reiterate again, are far from all being Russian, and all of which have been attacked on the high seas. In Russia, on this question, the speculation does not focus on Britain. It focuses on an entirely different party. And that party is Emmanuel Macron of France. The Russians, I think it's fair to say, mostly believe that it is Macron who is behind these Ukrainian attacks. Now, of course, I've seen no evidence at all that this is the case. And I have to stress again that all of this is speculative. But one can understand the cause of these speculations. Firstly, about 2 months ago, the French authorities boarded and briefly seized a so-called shadow fleet tanker. In other words, a tanker involved in shipping oil from Russia off the coast of France. French special forces boarded the ship. It was taken to France. The Chinese captain was held in detention for a while. The ship was searched because the French authorities, President Macron, alleged without any proof that the tanker had been used to launch drone attacks or at least drone surveillance over European bases and European airports and that kind of thing. No evidence of that kind was found on the tanker, and Macron was forced to release the tanker and release the captain, which went steaming on its way. So we can already see that Macron took the first step to seize a ship on the high seas with no actual evidence, though in the event he had to release it. And so the Russians have seen that Macron is prepared to take these extraordinary steps to try to tighten control, if you like, to interfere with Russia's oil exports. And I think the other thing that makes the Russians suspicious and believe that the French are involved is precisely the fact that these attacks on these ships are taking place off the west coast of Africa. Because despite the fact that France's presence in West Africa has significantly reduced over the last few years, the French still have a presence there. I believe they continue to have a presence, for example, in Senegal. And the government of Senegal, I believe, is still friendly to France. So if drone attacks on ships off the west coast of Africa are going to take place, the obvious Western country to assist in them would be France, because France is the historic dominant Western power in this region. There are other factors. Over the course of Zelensky's visit to France, the one that took place 2 or 3 days ago, Zelensky met with Macron, and Macron assured Zelensky that from February, the Russians would be facing severe problems, their economy would start to crumble, their finances would begin to disintegrate, all of those sort of things. And of course, Macron is one of these people who has, I think, almost entirely accepted the narrative that Russia is still massively over-dependent on oil to fund its budget, oil exports to fund its budget. In fact, this is an article of faith for advocates of sanctions in the West. And he believes that these sporadic attacks on ships involved in the oil trade, the Russian oil trade, will presumably bring this oil trade to a stop, and that this will create a major crisis for the Russian budget, and that will then lead to a crisis in the wider Russian economy, and presumably it will lead to some kind of financial or economic or some kind of collapse in Russia, and that will then be the moment when finally the West and Ukraine will triumph. I don't think I am summarising Macron's thinking wrongly. And of course, it remains the thinking of many people in the West. So, for example, the European Union has just imposed upon itself further decisions to stop all imports of Russian gas from 2027. And it's, of course, already decided that after 2027, it will cease to import oil completely from Russia. So they believe, they've convinced themselves that if they do that, that will choke off Putin's finances, the way they put it, make it impossible for Putin to finance the war. And, of course, they also believe that these attacks, these supposedly plausibly deniable attacks on the high seas, because, of course, there is no overt hand of France in this. People can assume, can speculate that it is France, but to say it again, there is no proof. Anyway, perhaps Macron believes that, you know, this is going to stop the oil trade. People will stop buying Russian oil because of that, and that will choke off the Russians and precipitate the sort of collapse that Macron is talking about. Now, I should say, first of all, that this entire premise that Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country, that it floats on a sea of oil and gas revenue, is completely wrong. Now, I've discussed this in many places, but as it happens, just a few days ago, on the 27th of November, in fact, the Russian Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, actually discussed this very question. And he said that sectors not related to production and refining of hydrocarbons already provide more than 3/4 of budget receipts, and their profitability increased by more than 13% when And Mishustin said this when summarising federal budget performance for 9 months of 2025. Development of the economy, expansion of the welfare of citizens, and certainly performance of all social commitments of the government depend on balanced growth of the economy. Financing of all these areas was backed by a significant rise in non-oil and gas revenues above 13%. This is, in other words, it increased funding receipts from the non-oil and gas sector increased by 13% over the course of 2025. Such addition was formed by industry, agriculture, undertakings in the spheres of services, finance and innovations. Their share in total revenues of the state is already above 3/4. They exactly make up the basis of the national economy, provide for budget stability. It is important not to soften budget discipline and continue the groundwork for the next year. I've been pointing this out for years, by the way, and I pointed out for years that people in the West overestimate the proportion of oil and gas receipts to the Russian budget. And it is indeed dwindling, and it is below 25%. Now, just to say, that 25% is not just made up of receipts from oil and gas exports. Russian oil and gas companies also sell oil and gas on the domestic Russian market. And that makes up, I believe, the larger part of their profits, as you would expect. And whatever Macron and company do to try to stop Russian oil and gas exports, some Russian oil and gas will continue to get through. And of course, oil and gas exports to China will be mostly unaffected because most of them go to China, the bulk of them go to China now by pipeline, by oil pipeline and by the Power of Siberia gas pipeline, which is in operation. So let us assume that the entirety of Russia's oil and gas exports stopped. It would not mean that Russia would lose 25% of its budget revenue. I'm not going to try and guess how much it would lose, but it would certainly be significantly less than 25%. 10%, no more. And of course, the Russians can compensate for that in all sorts of ways. They can increase taxes. They can float more bonds on the domestic Russian market. They did so recently, by the way. There was another bond flotation, Russian government bond flotation on Russian financial markets, more OFZs, and it was heavily oversubscribed. There is a big appetite within the Russian financial sector for buying Russian government bonds. This whole narrative is wrong. And what I would say about this is that if you have doubts about that, ask yourself this question. Who has been more consistently right about the Russian economy over the last 4 years? Those people who have been advocating sanctions, or sceptics like myself who have consistently pointed out these inconvenient and difficult facts? Anyway, let's put all that aside and let's go back to Putin. Because Putin reacted to these attacks on the tankers and he's furious about this. And his anger reflects the anger that is actually quite widespread on this question in Russia. So he was asked this question. please provide a comment on the attacks on tankers off the coast of Turkey. And as I said, now we know that there's also been attacks of Russian ships off the West African coast. Another such incident occurred just today. And Putin said this, frankly, I have not yet received that information. That's about the latest attack. I'm aware of the attacks on tankers in neutral waters, not even in neutral waters, but in the exclusive economic zone of a third state. The third state in question is Turkey. This is nothing short of piracy, and I believe he is right. I am not an expert in maritime law, or at least this kind of maritime law, but from memory, I do believe that attacks of this kind on ships conducting lawful business on the high seas constitutes the crime of piracy. Just saying. This is nothing short of piracy. The Ukrainian armed forces tried to hit our seaports as well. We responded. We did not start these operations with reciprocal strikes. I assure you that ours were much more effective and devastating. That is obviously true. They primarily targeted the ships that were used to deliver military equipment, material and ammunition to Ukraine. So Russian attacks on Ukrainian seaports have focused on attacking ships carrying weapons supplies to Ukraine, whereas Ukrainian attacks on Russian ports have attempted to stop Russian oil exports. But this might change now. We hit the targets we intended to hit, which we knew from secondary explosions we observed via aerial reconnaissance. However, what the Ukrainians are now doing is piracy. How might we respond? First, we expand the range of our strikes against port infrastructure and ships that enter Ukrainian ports. That is the first point. Secondly, if this does not stop, we will consider the possibility. I am not saying we will necessarily do this, but we will consider the possibility of reciprocal attacks against ships of those countries that help Ukraine carry out these acts of piracy. The most radical option would be to cut off Ukraine from the sea. Then piracy would be impossible in principle. But these are the things to think about if other measures fail. I hope the Ukrainian military and political leadership and those who stand behind them will give it a thought and see whether this practice is worth continuing. So this is a very strong warning given to Ukraine, but also given to the party that the Russians believe is behind these attacks, as well as Ukraine. And I have already said that I think that the Russians believe that that party is none other than Emmanuel Macron. And look what Putin is saying. He says, look, up to now, we have not been attacking ships that conduct normal, peaceful maritime trade with Ukraine. But if this continues, we might reconsider that. We will expand the range of our strikes against port infrastructure and ships that enter Ukrainian ports. Then he also says this, if this does not stop, we will consider the possibility of reciprocal attacks against the ships of those countries that help Ukraine carry out these attacks, these acts of piracy. So basically, if it's the French, and I suspect the Russians have information about this, and, well, as I said, it's been reported that it might be the French. If the French are helping the Ukrainians carry out attacks against ships which trade with us, then we reserve the rights to attack carry out reciprocal attacks against ships, French ships or French ships which trade with France. And then he says the most radical option of all would be to cut off Ukraine from the sea. Then piracy would be impossible in principle. Now, he says he does not want to do the second two. That is not his wish. But if this continues in the way that it is continuing, then the Russians will take these measures. They will not hesitate to take these measures in response. Now, attacks against French ships or ships that trade with France on the high seas. It's not unheard of. The Americans seize Iranian ships quite often on the high seas. The Iranians occasionally have seized ships too. They're not above doing that also. But if the Russians start to do this, and they start to do this against the French, then this is a major escalation and we would be in a major crisis. But look also at the other option that Putin is outlining here, a sea blockade of Ukraine. Now, I have been making this point now for years. The West has peddled the myth of some kind of great naval victory by Ukraine in the Black Sea. There is no truth to that claim whatsoever. The Russian fleet, the Black Sea fleet, is intact. One or two ships have been damaged, one or two ships have been sunk, but apart from the cruiser Moskva, which was destroyed early in the special military operation, and which was an old ship, the core of the fleet remains. And if the Russians wanted to close the Black Sea to merchant shipping, trading with Ukraine, they are fully able to do so. I say that because there has been this myth that Ukraine has been unable, that the Russians tried rather to impose a blockade on the Ukrainian coast, on Odessa specifically. I believe that the Russians did give serious thought to that possibility in 2022. They came up against a wall of criticism and opposition from the global south when they considered it. The global south was worried that it would affect Ukrainian grain exports and would lead to higher food prices. The Russians offered to supply food for free to global south countries in order to keep food prices low, but global south countries were not impressed, and the result was that the Russians made a political decision that they would not enforce a blockade. Putin is now threatening to do it, and the Russians have the means to do it. They can use their submarines to attack ships going to Odessa. They can mine the entry points to Odessa. They can use missiles and aircraft to strike at merchant ships trading with Odessa. They can actually seize ships in the Black Sea that are heading to Odessa as well. They've been able to do this at any time since the start of the special military operation. For political reasons, they have not done it. They are now threatening to do it. Now, I presume that by this point, the Russians feel that the war has dragged on long enough that they can explain this, if they have to do it, to the countries of the global south. And I believe, by the way, on that they are right. I don't think that this is simply a bluff. My point is, however, that if it is not a bluff, is this what Macron, assuming it is him who is supporting these operations, wants to see? Does he want to see French ships or ships trading with France attacked also on the high seas? Does he really want to see Odessa blockaded in this way? I would have thought not. Again, the extraordinary belligerence and recklessness of Macron, which has been so visible ever since the fall of Avdiivka in February 2024, is astonishing. And I know that it is causing alarm in France. And I think after these words of Putin's, it should cause even more alarm. At the very least, it seems to me that the French opposition, which has overwhelming support in France, if you take both the left and the right of that opposition and put them together, should be demanding answers from Macron. Is he involved in this? What does he think about it? Is he going to back off? Anyway, there we are. That was Putin's press conference, and it was an interesting one, and it tells us quite a lot about the mood in Moscow now. And to repeat again, all of this took place on the eve of the visit to Moscow of Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. Now, Witkoff and Kushner arrived in Moscow, and they were very courteously and warmly received, and they duly had their five-hour meeting with Putin in the Senate building in the Kremlin. Ushakov and Dmitriev were both there, and there's pictures, and you could see everybody looking happy and friendly with each other. I should say that I understand that Putin has a cold, but it doesn't seem to have slowed him down very much. He didn't just met with Kushner and Witkoff. He's also attended and given this press conference. He's also given a speech to an investment and business conference. Anyway, he's been busy, and he's, of course, preparing to travel to India as well, and will be travelling to flying to India tomorrow. And I suspect that today he will probably have a meeting with the Chinese Foreign Minister, Wang Yi, who is also in Moscow, and who yesterday had a very productive meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, and who is also going to meet with Sergei Shoigu, who is the secretary of Russia's Security Council. Anyway, Putin met Witkoff and Kushner, and as I said, there were lots of smiles. At least we see smiles in the cameras. Very different from the mood of the meeting between the Americans and the Ukrainians in Florida that took place over the weekend. But anyway, this looked like a friendly and cheerful meeting, and it went on for 5 hours. Now, again, the media in the West has been reporting this meeting as Putin rejecting the peace plan that Kushner and Witkoff brought with them. Now, again, this is a distortion of what happened over the course of this meeting, a distortion taken to the point of a misrepresentation. Because if you have been listening to what we've been saying on the Duran, if you've been watching these programs on this channel, you will know that the Russians had already signaled in advance that they did not accept the various documents. They did not see these documents that Kushner and Witkoff have been working on as proposals or peace plans. they certainly did not take the original 28 points as a proposal or a plan, as something that they would sign off on. What the Russians have said is that they saw them as items for discussion in future negotiations. And I said in advance that what the Russians might say and probably would say over the course of this meeting with Kushner and Witkoff in Moscow is that, yes, there are some parts, some of these 28 points that the Russians can work with, others that they are not happy with. But overall, yes, if it comes to it, if there is going to be a discussion, then it's possible to move forward on the basis of the original, of the original 28 points. And that's, it seems to me, exactly what came out of the meeting. The outcome was completely predictable, and what we on the Duran and I on this channel predicted. Again, Ushakov has been given the job of briefing the media. He said it was an extremely useful and constructive and substantive conversation. He actually said at one point that it was actually an enjoyable conversation, that the Russians enjoyed meeting with Witkoff and Kushner. And he said, we certainly talked with our American colleagues about the essence of the draft documents that the Americans sent to Moscow some time ago. We discussed these documents. We did not discuss the wording or specific American proposals. We discussed the essence of these documents. We agreed with some of them, as the president has told our American interlocutors, while other elements elicited some criticism, and our president made no secret of our critical and even negative attitude to some of the points. But what matters is we had an extremely useful discussion. I would like to reiterate that the most important thing is that the sides have stated their readiness to continue their joint work towards achieving a durable peace settlement in Ukraine. Then he went on to say that there's been no agreement on the territorial issues. How can they be? The Ukrainians, over the weekend, rejected all compromises in relation to them. So, given the stance that Umerov and the other Ukrainian negotiators took in their meetings with the Americans in Florida over the weekend, there was no possibility of the Russians signing off on anything. And the Americans, in that respect, came to Moscow empty-handed. But they did come with a series of proposals. And interestingly, Ushakov was asked which was the proposals that you were given. Was it the 28 points? Or was it the points, the 19 points, or the 22 points? And Ushakov said, if we're speaking strictly of points, there was a document comprising 27 points. I think that is the original document, by the way. It was handed to us, and we naturally reviewed its contents. However, we did not work on its wording, nor did we hold any discussions on this matter with our American colleagues. We received several further documents, four to be precise. So I've already said that there are many drafts setting out all sorts of people's ideas floating around, and we can see that there are now five in total. The original 27 or 28 points and four others. presumably these four others are the drafts that the Europeans have provided, other drafts which include ideas that incorporate some of the European ideas and American ideas, and of course other drafts still which include Ukrainian ideas. The point is that none of these drafts, not the original, none of the others were discussed. There was no discussion of wording, and as Ushakov also said, there was no agreement on any of the points because there were no discussions. No compromise options have yet been found. Some of the American proposals appear more or less acceptable. Nevertheless, they require further discussion. Certain wording we have been offered is not suitable for us. In other words, the work will continue. And then Ushakov also made it clear that the next step is for negotiating teams to be set up. He said that we agreed to continue contacts with the American side at the level of respective representatives, aides and other officials, particularly with the two individuals who visited the Kremlin today. As for a potential meeting at the presidential level, this will depend on the progress we're able to achieve as we work persistently and diligently through the channels of aides, foreign ministry representatives and other agencies. So exactly as I have been saying, the Russians have looked at all of this. They say some of this is nonsense. Some of this is unacceptable in its present form, but might be improved on. Some of it is closer to our ideas, but we have the basis for a substantive negotiation here. Whether that negotiation will be successful or not, no one at the present time can say. But if you want to talk and you want to come and meet with us and discuss these things with us, well, these are at least close enough to understanding our positions that we can find some things that we can usefully talk about. So let's conduct proper negotiations. We're prepared to do it if you choose. So the ball in effect is in the American court. They can go away, they can take the right lesson from this meeting, they can appoint a proper negotiating team, and they can meet with the Russians in Istanbul, in Budapest, or somewhere else, and they can move this process forward. Or they can walk away and say that this is impossible, that it's all too complicated. President Trump has spoken over the last 24 hours about this being a mess. Well, that's one way of looking at it, I suppose. And they can just say, well, this is too much. This is too complicated. We've got other more important things to do. Let's no longer waste more time on this intractable, impossible negotiation. It is up to the Americans. The ball is now wholly in their court. Well, I don't know what the Americans are going to do. I don't know what President Trump has in mind. But anyway, that's the suggestion that's coming from the Russians. And just to say, there's been, again, some misquotations of things that Ushakov said. There's been suggestions that he said that the Russians and the Americans are as far apart from each other as ever. What he said was this, and it was said in respect to a question: do you think we're closer or more remote following the talks? And Ushakov replied, not more remote, that is for certain, but much work will have to be done. In other words, there is some points that we can talk about, but we are nowhere close to the point of reaching a conclusion yet. So the Russians did not reject anything, at least from their point of view, because no offer was made to them. Just discussion points which were presented to them and which they agreed to discuss and to negotiate in detail about in future negotiations. Now, there is an intrigue about this meeting because there were some suggestions prior to the visit, including suggestions by me in my programme yesterday, that Witkoff was going to meet with Zelensky in Ireland and perhaps give him his marching orders. I'm not sure whether he did meet with Zelensky in Ireland. There were other reports that Zelensky was joined by Umerov in Ireland and that Zelensky and Umerov together wanted to meet Witkoff. I'm not sure whether that meeting ever took place. Kushner and Witkoff then went to Moscow. There was a lot of expectations that following that meeting in Moscow, Kushner and Witkoff would go either to Kiev or to whichever European capital Zelensky is currently at and meet him there and brief him on the Moscow talks. But they didn't do so. They flew directly to Washington instead. They didn't stop off anywhere in Europe. So anyway, it looks as if Kushner and Witkoff had this five-hour meeting, came away. As I said, everybody looked quite happy. I, of course, was not there, so I don't know how happy they really were, but Ushakov seems to think that the meeting went well. Rubio, by the way, has also spoken about it. He also says that the meeting went well, and there is some talk now about another telephone conversation between Putin and Trump. Presumably that will happen when Putin returns from India, where he is heading tomorrow. And the purpose presumably will be at that point to agree negotiating teams. This process, if it is a negotiating process, if it's going to happen at all, is at its beginning. It is nowhere close to an end. It's not anywhere close to an end because no substantive negotiations between America and Russia have taken place so far. Clearly, the Russians envisage direct negotiations between the Americans and themselves to end what both sides agree is a proxy war, that they are fighting against each other. The Europeans, as Putin said, have excluded themselves from the entire discussion. The Ukrainians obviously have a part to play, but as far as the Russians are concerned, it must be a subordinate role, and perhaps by this point, the Americans agree, which may explain why Witkoff and Kushner did not meet with Witkoff, with Zelensky, after this meeting in Moscow. Now, saying all of this, it's important to reiterate again that Witkoff and Kushner are not formally officials of the US government. I believe that Witkoff does have some official role. Kushner has none at all. He is simply the president's son-in-law. Rubio did not travel to Moscow. He remained in the United States. If there are going to be substantive negotiations, some American official, some senior American official will have to conduct them and will have to be the lead negotiator. It's unlikely that that will be Rubio or on the Russian side, Lavrov. They have too much to do. After all, they are the foreign ministers of their respective countries. But a good guess is that on the Russian side, it could be Ryabkov And on the American side, it might be Driscoll. But if negotiation teams are set up, they will have to go through all of these various points in these 5.5 documents. They will have to go through them point by point, see what kind of compromises might be reached. It might take weeks, it might take months, it could quite easily take years. And does Ukraine have those years? Well, I'm going to say straight away that I don't think so. Now, over the last 2 days, the Russians have said that they have captured Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians are denying it, and to my bafflement, continued bafflement, the Western media took at face value the Ukrainian denials, even though one thing happened which ought to show that these Ukrainian denials are worthless. Briefly, the Russians, after announcing the capture of Pokrovsk, released film footage of their soldiers raising flags in different places across Pokrovsk, including in the main square of Pokrovsk near the town administration building. Well, after that, a few hours after that, the Ukrainians also released their own video. And it was a video showing Ukrainian soldiers on the same square, which they had supposedly recaptured, driven the Russians away, apparently, recaptured the main square, in control again of the central administration building, and all of that. Except that those people who have better ability to analyze film footage, I have great difficulty analyzing film footage, but without exception, they all say that this is a fake and that it has been produced by AI. And I understand that this footage appears to show ordinary traffic on the roads in this main square, as if ordinary life was continuing in Pokrovsk as normal, which obviously proves that the footage is fabricated. I have no doubt that that is correct. The various people who've been saying that this footage is a fake appear to be the sort of people who I would judge to be completely reliable. Dima, by the way, at the Military Summary channel, has a good take on all of this. Now, that brings me to the claims about Ukrainian counterattacks in the Kupiansk area. If the Ukrainians are able to fake a whole video showing their control of Pokrovsk, why should anybody take what they say about Kupiansk seriously? I don't. Putin, when he says that territory is captured by the Russians and has done so recently, he's consistently been proved to be correct, as mostly has his chief of staff, Gerasimov. And of course, the Russian commanders of the various forces that claim to have captured Kupiansk have also said this. I have no reason to doubt that they're telling the truth, because their information has proved to be reliable. And as we see, Ukrainian information has not. Now, anyway, that's the situation in Pokrovsk. Russians are in secure control of Pokrovsk. Right across the front lines, the Russian advance has continued, and it continues remorselessly. The Russians announced yesterday that they captured a village called Dobropilia, This is not to be confused with the town of Dobropilia, which is located north of Pokrovsk. The village of Dobropilia is located north of Guliapolia, where the Russians, as we know, are fighting the Ukrainians. The Russians seem to be advancing south from Dobropilia towards a village called Varvarivka, which is immediately to the north of Guliapolia along the main road. The Russians, in other words, are capturing all of the territory on the west bank of the Ganshur River in this area and are breaking through the defence lines, the Ukrainian defence lines, allowing themselves to advance further westwards beyond Guliapolia itself. And this morning, the Russians also announced that they captured a village called Visokye, located immediately to the southeast of Guliapolia. And it looks as if they're preparing to capture another village called Marfupil, also located to the east, southeast of Guliapolia. And it is likely that over the next couple of days, Russian attacks on Guliapolia will intensify. And there are reports that basically all the supply lines to Guliapolia have now been cut. In which case, Guliapolia, perhaps not exactly in a cauldron, but Ukrainian reports themselves admit that Guliapolia is undefendable and that the Ukrainians are likely at some point over the next couple of days to withdraw from it. Now, there's been reports about further developments on the west part of Zaporozhye, close to the Dnieper and south of the great city of Zaporozhye itself. The Russian Defense Ministry, Gerasimov himself, told Putin that the Russians have encircled the Ukrainian positions, remaining Ukrainian positions, in the fortified town of Stepnogorsk. And in fact, various mapping projects have shown this. There's a small territory at the centre of Stepnogorsk made up of high-rise buildings. Apparently, it's this territory that the Russians claim to have surrounded. And there were reports this morning that the Russians have entered this territory and are in the process of storming it. And it looks as if Stepnogorsk also is about to fall. The fall of Stepnogorsk opens the way for the Russians to advance eastward, linking up with their forces, advancing eastwards from the east, westwards, and surrounding the town of Orekhov. At which point, all of Zaporozhye, apart from the city of Zaporozhye itself, will pass under Russian control. So the operational crisis for the Ukrainians in Zaporozhye continues to worsen. It is also worsening everywhere else simultaneously and at the same time. The Russians continue to enlarge the territory that they control northeast of Pokrovsk. The area of their breakthrough, the area of the numerous Ukrainian counterattacks, the Russians are there. And they are now regaining all of the territory that they lost over the course of these counterattacks. And as I've said previously, it looks as if they're preparing for an encirclement of Konstantinovka, the town which lies to the east of Pokrovsk. The Russians claim that they already control a third of Konstantinovka, and they've position themselves both to the east and to the west of Konstantinovka in ways that would make it possible for them to surround this town. And the Russians also in Siversk have made further progress, apparently. They have apparently managed to capture more places to the south of Siversk. There are reports that the Russians have now entered further villages to the south of Siversk as well. And there are reports that the garrison in Siversk, which is already fighting the Russians inside Siversk itself, that the garrison is in a cauldron. Reuters, the British news agency, recently published an article, which I learnt about from the British historian Jeff Roberts, about 11 Ukrainian soldiers that enlisted in the Ukrainian army this year. Several of them are dead, several of them are wounded, some have deserted. None of them are with the Ukrainian army anymore. Ukraine is facing a military crisis. The European Central Bank is refusing to support the 140 billion euro loan. And this morning, Belgium, ahead of the European Council meeting, at which the European Commission has again tried to float this proposal for the 140 billion euro loan, Belgium has said that none of the proposals made by the Commission remotely satisfy Belgium's concerns, and they remain opposed to the proposal and that they intend, presumably, to veto it. So the situation for Ukraine continues to get worse. I cannot understand why European governments, which know this, don't tell Ukraine, look, these ideas that the Americans are floating are the only way that you as a nation can survive now. Why instead we get foolish acts like the attacks on the tankers, even if it wasn't France and Macron, given that we are now getting attacks off the coast of Africa. Some Western country must be involved, and frankly, I do think it is France. Why is this being persisted in? I am unable to understand. Time is running out for Ukraine. Even if this negotiation process finally gets underway, I doubt that there is enough time. But logically, the Ukrainians ought to be giving the negotiations every conceivable support that they can. Well, they're not doing it. European foreign ministers met today. They again criticised the Russians for rejecting President Trump's proposals. An inane comment, as I've pointed out, given what actually happened at the meeting in Moscow yesterday. They continue to sabotage the proposals. Just as Putin said, all they can do is act as wreckers of any peace initiative in a war that anybody can see is now lost. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget to check out our Substack site. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.